Open Mic, the podcast.
Live your life your way at home with Davita Home Care.
Brought to you by WLR.
Pablo Picasso said, "Art washes away from the soul the dust of everyday life." Oscar Wilde said, "Art is the most intense mode of individualism that the world has known." Matisse said, "Creativity takes courage." And the duty of the artist or those involved in the artistic community to send light into the darkness of men's hearts. A certain Beethoven. Sitting in front of me now is a man with a full head of hair, spectacles on the nose, still wearing the same chinos that he wore 40 years ago. A nice brown Gansy on you there, Ollie. Ollie Breslin, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, hello.
Hi, Damien.
Thanks very much for coming into us.
You're welcome.
I saw the pictures in the paper there a few weeks ago and a few people said to me, now there's a man to do a podcast with, you know.
Yeah, because they want me to reveal all the scandal and the dark secrets.
Hard to believe it's 40 years, isn't it?
It's 40 years with Waterford Arts, but it's not the end of my art. I'm leaving Waterford Arts, but it's not the end of my artistic career. I'm hoping to do other things in the next few years, and not sure yet exactly what I'm doing, but I have a lot of experience in things like running arts organisations or festivals or social history things and all different things I've done over the time that I feel I could develop further. So I just think it's like a new chapter.
Couple of people were talking to me about many, many years ago, before Waterford Youth Arts, I think it was called Waterford Youth Drama or something like that. And somebody said all they did was just one play a year. When you went into it, why did you go into that?
We're going back in time, right? So Basically how it all happened was completely by accident. I'll tell you about Arts for All. The Arts for All organisation in Waterford was very important in the 70s, late 70s. Basically, it was set up through help from Combat Poverty Agency. They set up an organisation called the Waterford Resource Centre. And the Waterford Resource Centre were involved in all sorts of things like campaigns for people, flat dwellers, and all different campaigns around poverty and stuff like that. But they also had a wing which was about the arts. And it was a group of people in Waterford that were very passionate about the arts, people like Ted O'Regan, Liam Murphy, and a whole lot of other people. Margaret, I won't start saying names because I'll just get confused, but basically it was a whole lot of people who first of all wanted an arts centre in Waterford. They also said that there need to be better facilities in Waterford for the arts. What they did was they ran an arts festival every year. We used to be on November. A lot of the activities used to happen in Jeff's and in other places, in, you know, Downs's and places like that, the Union Hall. The festival really was to highlight the arts, but really campaign for an arts centre in Waterford. So out of that came the Arts for All Theatre Company. And then there was, at a certain point in their progression, they said they would set up a, you know, like one of these government-funded schemes for young people, because there was an awful lot of youth unemployment in Ireland at the time. And they said they would set up a youth training project for doing murals, actually. They got approval from the Department of Labour. So they're all set to do it. And then the artist, whoever the artist was, pulled out. Here they had approval for a government scheme to involve young people in a training project for young people, and said, they said, what we're going to do? And Ted O'Regan at the time said, look, I'm taking early retirement from the council, Waterford Council, and I would love to do a theatre project. He said, I'll do this and I'll take on a group of young people and I'll train them in community theatre. So that's the background. So here was I was off doing my travels. I was off travelling. I spent about 4 years travelling after I left school and college. I went off, first time I was for 3 months, next one was for 9 months, and then I went away for a year and a half. And when I was coming back that last time, I said I wanted to do something with my life. I didn't want to just come back, because every other time I came back, I just got jobs in factories. Basically, just get money to go away. That's all. Because you could get really good money in a factory. And of course, you told lies and said, oh, I'm going to be here for life. And then after 6 months, you left. So I worked in Seekman's. I worked in Yall Carpets. I worked in Hedenza. I worked in, I can't remember a company. We used to make suppositories. And I used to tell, and my girlfriend also thought I worked in an artificial limb factory, because in Seekman's, they made elbows. Metal elbows, you know, for piping, for corners of piping. And she thought I was working in an artificial limb. So I used to do all that save up a few bob and then head off on my travels.
Where did you go, different places?
First of all, it was around Europe and then down to Morocco. And then the next time I went down through then Algeria, Tunisia, and then over to Malta and Sicily, and then up through Italy and right up. Then up to Holland. I spent a month in Holland and came back then eventually back to Ireland. The last time I went away, I went to down to Greece. I went hitchhiked. I was all hitchhiking now, by the way. So, I mean, I hitchhiked. I was a professional hitchhiker. I could run classes on hitchhiking, how to do it and how to get picked up and where the best place to stand and how do you, you know, how to look enthusiastic. And
there was an art in it.
Absolutely. And the thing is, I never smoked cigarettes when I was a young fella, right? Never did when I was a teenager. But when I started hitchhiking, I started to smoke cigarettes because I needed to stay awake. You know, if you're hitchhiking, you get a lift and you get into a car and very hot, you'd end up falling asleep. So I used to, like, you know, if they're smoking, I'd end up smoking cigarettes and just to stay awake, you know, because you can't fall asleep in someone's company. If they're driving you 100 miles, you can't be falling asleep. So you'd have to be kind of trying to communicate be awake. Anyway.
Did you ever have any bad experiences in the...
I had loads of bad experiences, but we won't go on to them now because I had loads of good experiences. I remember people literally out for their Sunday drives, they end up bringing me like 80 miles to a place. I remember a man picked me up in Algeria and he said to me, you know, where did you sleep last night? And I said I slept in a hammam. Now, a hammam is, you know, like a Turkish bath. Mm. And in the nighttime in Arab countries, the Turkish bath becomes a hostel, basically, for migrant workers and people that are travelling, that don't have much money. Obviously, that's where I travelled. That's where I slept when I was travelling through a lot of the Arab countries. So basically, you just put bunks in and you're in, like, you know, a dormitory kind of situation. And you'd obviously, you know, put your possessions in your sleeping bag and, you know what I mean, off your... And you get a good night's sleep. But anyway, he was really embarrassed when he heard that I was sleeping in a hammam. So he said, no. And he was very wealthy. And he drove me over and he booked me into the most expensive hotel in Algeria, right? It was like a resort that was outside Algiers for all the kind of people working in the oil industry and all that kind of stuff, right? I went in. I was absolutely manky to everything. And they looked at me, you know, at the reception. And I went in. I was only in there for one night. And I took off all my clothes, everything, washed everything. And I was in the shower. I was washing all my clothes, hanging them all up all over the place. Brilliant. And then I said, oh, sure, I better go down and get something to... I knew I wouldn't be able to afford, you know, to eat very much there or drink there or whatever. But I went down anyway and I got a snack and I went into the bar and I said I'd have a glass of beer or something like that. And I was having a glass of beer and this guy came over to me after a while. I was sitting there on my own and I was reading a book or something and this guy came over and he was all denims and long hair. And he said, it's very unusual to see a fellow like you in here, he said. And I said, well, you're looking a bit unusual yourself. And he says, yeah, but I'm working in the oil industry, you know. And it turns out he had a house behind the hotel. Oh, you know, if you're staying there for a while, you have a house off the hotel, right? So I ended up staying with him for 2 weeks. He had the best of wine. He brought me for meals every night. He was just basically lonely. He was a young guy over there working. He was very a geologist. We ended up having a great time. He brought me around. And it's really funny, when I eventually left Algeria, I went right down to the south and I was going through the Sahara Desert into this really small little outpost. The guy on the border said, show me your passport, because in Algeria you have to declare how much money you have when you come into the country on your passport to show that you're not going to be a vagrant, right? So he looked at my passport and he said, you didn't spend any money, in our country. And I said, oh, I know. I said, it's a long story. You know. And he said, no, you cannot leave. And I said, what do you mean? He said, you must go back, spend at least, you know, 100 quid or whatever it was, right, before you can leave. So I had to go back to the nearest town, right, buy a whole load of presents, post them to people at home, and none of them arrived. None of them arrived. And then I went back to the border and he left me through into Tunisia. And then off I went. But what I'm saying is, every day something happened. To this day, I mean, some of my friends say, oh, God, don't start telling me another story. But like, it was 4 years of my life. But the amount of things that happened, you know, mad things, like, you know, up in the Kif Mountains in Morocco. Or actually, one interesting story that's relevant to now was, I was only thinking about this recently. When I was in Crete, I met these couple of young English women and they told me that they'd met this guy from Palestine. He wanted to set up an alternative in Jordan. We say the equivalent of what kibbutzes were in Israel. Right. He wanted to set up the equivalent in Jordan. And myself and these three young women went with him. We flew from Athens to Jordan, to Amman, and we embarked on this project that we were going to set up an alternative. This is 1981. One of the young women got cold feet and she flew back to England. And the other young woman stayed. This man, he was a businessman. Mohammed was his name. He put irrigation pipes into farms in the, you know, all over Jordan. So he had money. The plan was that both Sandy, the English woman, and myself, we would learn Arabic for the first few months. And then after that, we would look about how we would set up this thing and all that. So he put me out into the field as such with a group of six young Egyptian men who were laying irrigation pipes. And for the next couple of months, that's what I did. I worked with these lads out in the fields, putting in irrigation pipes. I was a bit of an expert after a few months. And,
learning Arabic.
Learning Arabic with these young Egyptian guys. And yeah, it was actually lovely. We used to just, we'd be moving from farm to farm. We'd be, say, in one farm for a week and then another farm for another week and so on. And we'd be staying in some shed on the farm. And the lads would have their own gas thing and they'd cook and we'd eat together and we would sleep in together, wash up and sleep. And every night, and I know you're interested in music, if every night at 9 o'clock they'd put on the radio and they'd wrap up in the sleeping bags and they'd turn on this particular program. And I think it was on a Palestinian radio station from 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock every night. And a woman called Umm Kulthum, she is an Egyptian singer. She's one of the most famous women singers of all time in the Arab world. The music was really interesting because there would be an orchestration, like a big orchestra, doing a big intro for maybe 5 minutes before she sang. The music would build and build and build and build, and then she would come in. And the boys would just melt. The lads in their sleeping bags, they'd be there and they'd be crying, singing along. They'd be shouting encouragement to her. and I'd be there looking at it and I'd be like, I began to fall in love with Umm Kulthum. It's very acquired taste. It's not like, I think people here would find it a bit strange, but it's a very Arabic, passionate. It probably, well, it was very beautiful. The closest we have would be Shano singing. You know, that, yes, that thing, yes, where you're singing from the heart and it's very passionate.
Stay with us, Ali and Umm Kulthum. Back in a few minutes. Ali Breslin. Ali, I suppose there's a backstory to that. You left that area because I think there was some political turmoil, wasn't there?
I suppose the back part of that story is that there was a coup attempt in Jordan about 2 years beforehand. So when she left, I left. And that was the end of our attempt to set up the alternative to kibbutzes in Jordan.
And why did you feel the need to, when I was 18 and a half, after my first year in college, I went off to Brazil and I just loved Rio, the idea of it, and I went off selling sandwiches on Copacabana Beach. Why did you feel the need to travel? Was there anything in your family? Was it just something at the time?
I think my mother probably felt that she would have loved to travel. And I think that she probably made us aware of that as we were growing up. Now, at the same time, everyone in my generation, like three of my family emigrated of five.
Tell us about the family, just so we have.
So just emigration was normal
was
at that time. Emigration was normal. And I'm just saying that I think, because my older sister went off travelling before me. She went off to Spain a number of times. She got deported, I think, twice from Spain, because that was during Franco's time.
Oh, yes, of course.
And to be a hippie in Spain that time was frowned upon. And she got picked up a few times for not having any money. They deported you. And she, I suppose, led the way. Mm. And then, you know, the rest.
Where did you come in the family?
I was the baby.
Baby of how many?
Five.
Five. And who else was there?
Patsy, my brother, is the oldest.
Yep.
He's 10 years older than me. He's nearly exactly 10 years older than me.
Okay. How old are you now, Ali? Sorry for asking.
I'm 65. He's 75.
Okay.
Then you have Maria. Maria is now, she's the hippie woman that went off on her travels. She's dead. Then you have Phil, who lives in Essex in London. By the way, Maria lived in the UK and then she lived in America before as well. And then Neil, who recently died, he spent a lot of his life in the UK and also America. He also spent time in Israel with kibbutzes. He started off in the kibbutz and went to Moshav.
Oh.
When I was in traveling around Egypt and that area and Jordan, I went to visit him a couple of times in Israel. And I saw what was like in Israel at that time and what was like for Palestinians. I worked in hotels in Jerusalem because I always had this philosophy that I would try and not spend money and work where I could. So for example, in Jerusalem, I worked in hotels, so I didn't have to pay for hotels, but also it meant I could cook in the places. So,
of course.
And then in when I was in Greece, I picked olives and worked on a farm, and I worked in different places. So you'd always try and get work as you go along when you're traveling. To go back to my family is very interesting because we're what they call blow-ins, in the sense that my mother was from Derry and my father was from Donegal. That's an interesting story because they met in a place called Blahy. Seamus Heaney has now, the Seamus Heaney Centre is in Blahy.
Yes.
Blahy at the time when my father and mother were there, because that's where they met. Mm. My father went there when he was 12 to work. That was normal because he came from a family in Donegal where there was 14 children.
Yeah.
A lot of the older ones didn't even know the younger ones until later on. All of the older ones had to leave and go and get jobs. You know, my father was lucky. He went to work for a cousin in Belahi and things worked out for him. But he worked there from when he was 12. And then in his early 30s, he met my mother and she was a housekeeper for the priest. So she was from a place called Park near Clawdy. She was working for the housekeeper for the priest and they met.
What was your father doing?
He was working for his cousins. And this is the other thing too. Belahi at that time, right, it was very divided. The Breslins had the Pope, had a shop and had a grain store and a delivery company and my father worked for them.
Right.
So he's Breslin. But there was also the Protestant pub, the Protestant grain store, the Protestant, you know, businesses, much bigger, much more money. Basically, the Catholic farmers would work, you know, would go to the Catholic people. That's where it was at the time. I mean, that area, Blahy, that area, within that area, there was four hunger strikers that died. You know, there was two from Blahy, there was one from Clawdy and one from near where my mother, near the chapter that ran for election in Waterford.
Oh, yes, Kevin Lynch.
His family would be related to my mother. So I suppose the reason why I'm telling you this is that they were quite Republican. And the reason why they came to Waterford was that basically my mother became pregnant.
Okay.
And that was a big scandal at the time.
So they weren't married at the time?
No. And so then, this was a big scandal because it's really funny because even some of my father's family saw my mother as having kind of trapped my father. Like, it's like they looked down on her, even though they had nothing. But it was really funny.
What year did they come to Waterford?
1949.
49. Why did they pick Waterford? Was it just as far
basically,
away from
Belahy? They opened up a newspaper. I imagine it was the Sunday Press to look at property for sale. And they saw a pub for sale in Waterford. And my father came down and looked at it. Now, just to let you know, the other man that he worked for, his uncle, he bought the pub. My father didn't have the money to buy a pub. The uncle who he worked for 20-something years, he bought the pub from. He said, I'll buy you a pub down the south. You can start off. I think that my uncle saw my father as like himself. Because my uncle left Donegal when he was about 10 or 12 to work in the north and he became successful. So I think he wanted to look after my father.
See, yes.
And so they bought a pub in Waterford. They arrived down, they opened up this pub and they knew nobody. But the beauty of it was that we were all then born in the pub, right?
Where was the pub?
In Patrick Street. You know where Spokes Bicycle Shop is?
Yes.
Next door there's a hairdresser's.
Yes.
The hairdresser's, that was our pub. So the graveyard, St. Patrick's Graveyard was our playground, right? We played in there. We climbed out our first floor window and played in there. And so the pub was a really local pub with sawdust on the floor. And all the clientele were from Corrigan Lane, Stephen Street, Alexander Street, all around that area. Most of them were dockers, factory workers. And at that time, there was a book, like people bought drink and paid for it on when they got their wages.
Yeah.
That was the system. Because of our pub was next to the graveyard, we used to have an awful problem this time of year of smoke blowing down the chimneys because there was big high trees in the graveyard.
Oh, yeah.
And it created this downdraft.
Yeah.
The lads in the pub would be chatting away and without even missing a beat in the conversation, they put their hands over the top of the glasses when they heard a sound, because the soot came down the chimney and landed on the drink and would destroy the drink. The lads would just put their hands automatically on the glasses. The soot would land on the back of their hands.
I've never heard of that. That's amazing.
And anyone that wasn't a local would be going, oh, God, I'll just stay to me drink. And they'd have to bring it up to my father, and my father was, or my mother, and they'd replace the drink. And the locals would be laughing at them, saying, oh, shit, you haven't a clue. Like, these trees just created this downdraft and we couldn't do anything about it.
And was it a happy childhood?
Oh, yeah. But because we had a pub, my father also worked in Clover Meats. He was so working all day in the factory.
70-80 hours a week, probably.
Then coming home, working at the pub to close the time, having to wash down the pub then. And then, you're talking about 7 days a week he worked, right?
Yeah.
So the only time we had with my father, really, socially, was Sunday. There was a real funny hours on Sunday where the pub closed from 2 o'clock to about 5 o'clock.
Yeah, that's right.
We used to have the dinner and then we'd go off for the Sunday spin. And my father would get lost out the country. And my mother would go, you're feckin' lost. You haven't a clue. And my father, do you know what he used to always do was, he'd end up getting out of the car and talking to some farmer. And they'd be leaning on the gate and they'd be chatting. And this is what my father was looking for. And then he'd get back into the car and he'd go, oh, I took a wrong turn back there now. And off he'd go. But he'd love to just be standing by the side of, you know, a gate at a field and talking to a farmer about the crops and, you know, the weather and blah, blah, blah.
And that may have unconsciously got into your spirit in terms of art and stuff. We'll talk about that in a minute. What, you remember any type of cars, by the way?
The cars, well, it was A40. Remember the Austin A40?
Yeah, and I remember hearing about that.
There was another one too.
Morris Minors now?
Yeah, no, we didn't have Morris Minor. That was very fancy. Like, my father started off with a bicycle. Because I remember a funny one. Because he used to cycle to Clover Meats, right, at the start. And I remember there was murder one time because the bike got robbed. From outside the pub, the bike got robbed. And my mother, she gave us, myself and my sister, she gave us a few bob to go up to St. Anthony in the, the Friary, Bridge Street, the Medigan.
Yeah.
I think it might be St. Martin up there, was it? Go up and say a prayer. My mother loved all the saints. My mother's relationship with the Catholic Church was a bit like voodoo. You know, she had all the saints for different reasons and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, she gave us a few bob to head up and to put in the box and light a candle for the bicycle. And we were walking up the stony steps and I saw a bicycle. And I said to Phil, I said,
that's the bike.
Phil, that looks a bit like Daddy's bicycle. And she said, no, it couldn't be. And I went up and I looked and, you know, on the front of the bike, there was a little St. Christopher thing on it, right?
Right, yeah.
And I saw it and I said, that's Daddy's, definitely. And we got very excited. And I said, I'll stay here because I think the bike was Banjax. There was like, you know, something wrong with it. The back wheel might be gone or something. Phil ran back to the pub. And anyway, it was the bike. So it was a miracle. It was a miracle. St. Martin did it. Do you know what I mean? We didn't even get up to Medigan and we found the bike. So, happy days. That whole thing of the pub and the old people and the community and all that,
yeah.
I think that really stood to me around my love, you know, for like, I love doing these social history films with old people and all that kind of stuff. I think it really came from there.
Hold that thought, Ollie. We'll investigate that now in a second. Stay with us.
Open Mic, the podcast.
Live your life your way at home with Davita Home Care.
Brought to you by WLR.
Welcome back. You're listening to a lovely chat myself and Ollie Breslin are having. Ollie, you were going to tell me about some people that used to frequent the pub all those years ago.
There was two men used to come into our pub every day. Jack Kelly was a really haughty-taughty kind of guy. He had a waistcoat. He had a little pencil moustache and he had a gold chain. He used to go over to our pub every day at about, I don't know, whatever time, 3 o'clock or something, with Morris Hogan. Now, Jack Kelly was ex-British Army. He'd been off in Africa. Not there for the Boer War, but it was after that. And he just telling me little stories about riding around on his horse and looking at the native women washing themselves. I used to find it very interesting. And he used to be drinking with Moddy Hogan. Now, Moddy Hogan was a small little man, only about, I'd say he was about 5 foot, if he was 5 foot, right? And he was very thin and very slight. But he was a tinsmith in Stephen Street. He'd be the last tinsmith in Waterford, right? He'd be there all day, every day going hammering away all day, making pots and pans and repairing stuff for farmers and all that. I even met people since who taught me that they had got plates and mugs from Moddy Hogan on the tick because they were so poor. They taught me that. And I didn't know that now until much more recently. Moddy Hogan would be there. And Moddy Hogan was an ex-IRA man. And he is reputed to be the only man to have ever escaped from Ballybricken jail. And how he escaped was, you know, in the old bread vans, when they pulled out the drawers for the bread, he apparently escaped in one of them. He was so skinny and small, right? He climbed out.
Slid into it.
Now, I presume it was in with the knowledge of the guy in the bread van, but he escaped. But here is this old British gentleman. Now, he was from Waterford, but he had this old, very haughty-taughty accent. And Moddy Hogan, who he could barely get a word out of. And the two of them used to come over every day to our pub, and you could set your clock by the time they'd come. So that was very interesting for us growing up, that we felt very much part of a community in Waterford and very much part of the life of Waterford. And
we've completely, obviously, gone off where we were supposed to go, and that's the reason I love this type of chat.
When you Arts for All. So when I came back from my travels, I said I wanted to do something in Waterford. And what had in my head was the Waterford Resource Centre. They wanted to set up co-ops. And I used to go up to Miles Shelley. Miles Shelley worked up there. And I used to go up to Miles regularly and say, Miles, when are these co-ops being set up? I really didn't want to go back working in places where I'd be just bored
elbows,
and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do something where I'd be part of the whole thing in some way. So I thought co-ops, and I'm a bit of a socialist, obviously. And Miles said one day, and I was plaguing him now. I was coming up to him every week, and I was plaguing him. And he said one day, I remember it was a lashing rain. He says, Ollie, I have to go down and pay an ESP bill down the mall. He said, get in the car, we'll drive down, and I'll talk to you about something on the way down. On the way down, he said, there's this Arts for All thing starting off. It's a theatre company. And he says, I want you to go for it. I said, Miles, I won't be interested. He said, look, please, Ollie, just think about it. And I remember going home to my girlfriend at the time and I told her about it. And she wanted to do it. And then she looked about it and then she wasn't eligible because you need to be unemployed for a while and all that kind of stuff. She said, oh, Ollie, you do go. Please go for it. So I went. And I went very reluctantly, and I remember going to it, and there was this head case there, and it wasn't like a normal thing. You went into a room, and there was this guy with a big mad white hair, mad eyes, and he was Ted O'Regan, and he was getting us to do all sorts of mad things, like feeling the space around us, and he's getting us to do all these really strange things, and I thought it was very amusing, but I didn't really participate until the very end. The very end, he did a role play, and the role play was that he was playing the part of at the council, you know, Waterford council official, and it was going to be a public meeting, and we all got a piece of paper, and on the piece of paper was, you know, some of us were all living in this particular inner city housing, and it was all going to be knocked down for a new road. We were all going to be moved out to the suburbs of Waterford, and some of us were absolutely delighted, because it meant that we were going to have nicer houses, three-bedroom houses, and some of us were really against it. Mm. And I got the one that I was against it. And I was happy with that one. So anyway, we were having the public meeting. And again, I left the people, other people there have their spoke. And eventually I got kind of fed up and I said, oh, hang on a minute, I want to say something. And I made some passionate speech about, like, where I live is very important and I don't want to be having to get a bus. And anyway, buses won't be frequent, and made this passionate speech. And then a couple other people joined in with me and we had a good old row. And that was it. And then afterwards there was an interview, a private interview. And I remember going in, Ted O'Regan and Clodagh Walsh, and I think it was Anne O'Brien. They had an interview and the two women were really enthusiastic. But Ted kept looking at his watch. Like, as if, like, when is this fucking fella just be gone out of this office, right? I got through it anyway. I left. And I even said to him, I don't want to do it. I said, look, there's a lot of people in there need a bit of confidence boosting. And I said, I don't need confidence boosting. And I said, I want to be doing something interesting, but I don't want to be, you know. Anyway, they offered me the place. And I went on it with, called ourselves Kit Togue after a while, which is a left-handed person. And Kit Togue, Ted liked that because it's the creative side of your brain is the right-hand side, and he liked the idea that we were looking at the creative part of ourselves. And that changed my life. Going into Catogue with Ted, and he trained us for the next year and two and a half years.
Were you disappointed you got the job?
Huh?
Were you disappointed you got the job?
Well, I
don't mean that in a bad way, but you know what I mean?
I said I'd do it for a while.
Yeah.
And I went in and I actually had a ball, and I ended up having a brilliant time, and it was fantastic. And so when Catogue finished, because after about 3 years it ran out of money, the scheme finished and everything, and we couldn't get any money off the Arts Council, we all went our separate ways. And I went off and I set up this newspaper called The Bull Post, and we had 6 editions and it went to the wall. And I remember Paddy Gallagher meeting us because he was setting up Waterford Today, and it was kind of, we kind of got the head of him, got out before him, and he was very worried. And he met us because they were bringing out Waterford Today.
Yeah.
And I think after he met us, he kind of realised he didn't have to worry about. So,
and why didn't it work?
Oh, sure, look, it was by advertising. He had to go sell ads, and we brought it out every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So we lasted 3 months, and we lost a fortune. all of our savings were gone. And we lost all our friends as well, because to get these things out, we had to work like fucking dogs. During all this, one of the people that was in Catogue, Claire Hayes, set up this youth theatre thing, and she contacted me and said, "Ollie, can you help me?" I said, "What? What's wrong, Claire?" She said, "I'm at setting up this youth theatre. We're after meeting. We're going about a week now or so. We need a bit of help. Will you come in?" And I said, "Okay." I came in, helped her out, and we ran the workshops. 3 months later, she emigrated, and she left me with the baby. And that was 40 years ago.
You're one of the only people, I was talking again to a few people ahead of this interview, who has managed to continue to make an income, to have an income, to have a job out of arts administration in Waterford over 4 decades. People have come and gone. People have been involved in various theatre groups. As an administrator, that's great credit to you. That's brilliant. And some people would say, that's an easy thing to do. It's not an easy thing to do.
No, I mean, I know people always take the piss on me and say, you're still getting the grants, Ollie. You're still getting the grants. And of course,
shouting across the road, yeah.
For years and years and years, you know, after Spree, people were saying, "Well done, Ollie, well done." And the first few times it happened, I kind of went kind of nearly apologetic, saying, "I'm not really involved." And then after a while, I said, "Fuck it." So for the last 20 years, I've been getting all this praise for organising Spree. And because people think we're all the one. You know, something really good happens with Red Kettle, they go, "Oh, well done, Ollie." Something really good happens with Gareth Lane, "Well done, Ollie. Thanks very much. Thank you. But they don't realise we're all separate organisations. Now, what's lovely about Waterford is we all help each other out. And we all work together. You know, for example, a lot of the people that end up in Spree, they all would have started with us and all that kind of stuff. That's how it works. And we look out for each other, and we share equipment and all that kind of stuff. And there's a great sense of cooperation in Waterford in the arts. And it's a lovely atmosphere in the arts. There's still ways for people to get into the arts in Waterford, which is not available in other places in Ireland. We don't necessarily, we're not 100% focused on the piece of paper. If you come into Waterford and you can do a job well, we want you. You'll keep getting work. But just to go back to getting the grants, every arts organisation in Ireland are on a 1-year grant. So every year we have to apply for a grant. And every year we get it, unless we feck up, right? And we don't usually try and do that, right? It's an annual funding. So you don't have, here's another one, there's no pension scheme for the arts. There's no pension scheme for youth work either, which is really mad. So even though I've worked 40 years, I don't have a pension. And I met a woman recently down in Wexford who is 72 and she is still a youth worker. And I said, "Why are you still a youth worker?" She said, I've got a mortgage and I need to pay the mortgage. I'm just saying is that we work very hard and we work really odd hours. My work mostly happens in nighttime and weekends, during the summer and during the Easter and during Christmas. I can tell you, if you want proof of my amount of hours that I do, just ask my family and they'll tell you, like, you know, when you, it's the opposite problem is I spend too much time in Watford Arts and not enough time at home and doing other things.
How have you kept enthusiastic after all these years?
Well, I think it's easy when you work with young people. Working with young people is it's fantastic, and it's really brilliant because I always get a shot in the arm, always, from young people, because they're passionate and they're really interested. And for them, it's a new thing. They're discovering their creativity. It's brilliant.
And to see them grow and develop artistically. I was just talking to Michelle out in the open plan, and she was involved many years ago in one of your many creations. And she just, like, the wonderful buzz then around that.
And I love the fact that, like, I can see lads. If I go out to, say, out to Downs's or
whatever,
Jordan's or Philly Grimes or whatever, I see groups of lads together and I know they met in Watford Arts.
Yeah.
And they're still friends today. And that's brilliant. And we have now grandchildren. We've grandchildren coming in to Watford Arts. And their parents met in Watford Arts. You know what I mean? So that's really...
That lovely. Yeah,
that's kind of cute. You know what I mean? And so I get a sense that it's here forever. It's going to be here forever. And that's why I decided to leave Watford Arts. I wasn't asked to leave. And I could be there for the next 10 years if I want to be there. But I decided to leave because I want to leave now when it's in really good shape and it's going really well. And I also think a younger person should be running a youth organisation, and they don't need a dinosaur hanging around, right? But the dinosaur is still available for other work, right? And I do have lots of energy, and I do have lots of ideas, and I'd still be passionate about the arts, and I still believe we have an awful lot of work to do in the arts as regards making it accessible, democratising it, and making people feel that the arts is for everybody. I really believe in that whole idea from the very start, that the arts are for all, because I believe that when you're born, you are innately, you're just innately creative. You're curious. You have this belief that you can do anything and all that kind of stuff. And then society begins to knock it out of you. That's what I love about working with the young people in the arts, is that we can reignite that and help that to flourish and develop. I mean, a lot of time when I work with adults, a lot of times I try and help them to play, to learn to play again, because they forget that the fun and the sense of, you know, the buzz that they get out of playing, you know, physically playing games and stuff like that, they come alive. A lot of the stuff we've learned in the arts and during drama and all that kind of stuff, you can apply to anybody. And I know an awful lot of, we say, big multinational companies are using some of these things as well for group work and for team building and all that kind of stuff. We try and do it from a point of view of helping people and helping people to kind of find out a little bit about themselves and find out a little bit about their abilities. And, you know, what I love about the arts is that there's room for everybody. You know, people think, oh, I'm not very good at acting. Acting's a really small part of the arts. Like for example, I'm involved also with Watford Film Centre and the chairman of that. I'm involved in the Imagine Arts Festival. I'm involved with the Ted and Mary O'Regan Bursary. I can honestly say now that there's plenty of work in the arts in Ireland, particularly in the film industry.
Lots of people texted me in originally about this. Mary Roach has just texted as well. How does Ollie feel about the arts are supported or otherwise in Ireland, arts careers now versus when he started, basing income for the arts scheme? I think you've touched on that. And what should Waterford be looking to achieve? We'll just take that last one. What should Waterford be looking to achieve?
First of all, I'd say Waterford Council is doing a good job as regards the amount of money they're putting into the arts.
Yeah.
But I do think they could restructure things differently. We've got two arts officers. Do we need two arts officers? I think we could do with changing the role of one arts officer, and one role should be around looking at capacity and helping the people who are working in the arts to develop. In relation to the basic income of the arts, I'm really disappointed with what I've heard today, actually. There was 8,000 applicants originally. They picked 2,000 to go on a pilot scheme. They also picked 1,000 people to be a... What's the name of it, where you don't get funding, but they want to include you in the actual survey? And 1,000 people agreed to that. They were able to prove for a fact that the basic income of the arts works. And instead of rolling it out nationally, they're arsing around with.
Somebody else just texted in, how has Ollie not changed in his appearance in 20 years? How is he looking so young?
Someone said recently online, they said, 40 years working in the arts and one pair of chinos, he said. And, my fashion has not changed that much.
And your hairstyle, you still have a good head of hair.
During the punk era, I was dressed the same, even though I was really into punk music.
Chinos in the punk era.
I remember going, myself and my brother Neil went up to see The Clash in Dublin. Neil, my brother, was a great influence on music. He was the guy that used to buy 3 albums a week from Cobb Records in Wales. He used to import them from, because he couldn't get the Sinnets, Patsy Ryan and Sinnets couldn't keep up with them. So Neil used to have a mail order scheme from Cobb Records in Wales. He was working in the post office. He started off as a telegram boy and then postman, but he'd buy 3 albums a week. I remember one album he got was Steely Dan.
Somebody else, very brief question, very difficult question, what is Ollie most proud of?
God, well, I suppose I'm most proud of Waterford Arts. What I'd love to see in 100 years time is an organisation like Waterford Arts in every city in Ireland. I remember about 25 years ago, these young people arrived over. They were visiting Jane Keane, I think, up in Piltown, and she brought them down to come to something in Waterford Arts, and we met up and blah, blah, blah. And I remember they were from Portsmouth in England or something. And they said, I would love if there was an organisation like this in Portsmouth. And like, people forget, this is actually not normal. What we have in Waterford of Spree, Waterford Youth Arts, and Little Red Kettle, Garter Lane Arts Centre, and the Theatre Royal, and all these other things, all the musical theatre companies we have in Waterford, this is not normal in the rest of Ireland. It's not normal in the UK. It's not normal in the rest of Europe. And I just think that, like, we need to kind of wake up and realise that what we have is something really brilliant, and it's really unusual. In a lot of other places, it's all private stuff. It's all money. Kids, families that have money can get into things. That's not the way it is in Waterford. The other thing which by accident was the social history films that we did in Waterford Arts. That all happened by accident because we moved up to Barrack Street. Historians would be looking at these things and they'd go, oh, wow, that's what Ireland was like in the 50s, or that's what Ireland were like in the 60s or the 70s, whatever it is. And so these films will be really important and gives people an insight into all sorts of professions and all sorts of pastimes and all sorts of mad things that we just took as normal when we were growing up.
You're very modest. A lot of what you're talking about is down to you. You're one of the most important, if not the most important person in the arts in Waterford in the last 4 decades. Thank you.
Well, there's a few more of us now.
I know there are.
Like, I especially Jim Nolan and TV Hone.
You're all cut off the same cloth.
Yeah,
and
we all come from that same arts for all background and same thing of like, the arts is there for everybody and there's no big deal about it. It's not highfalutin stuff. It's about ourselves and about our own journey and all that kind of stuff.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Where do you get the haircut, by the way? Where's the barbers? Have you got a barber?
Oh, God. I used to go to one particular barber because he had a cat. I love cats. And I used to go down and he'd say, I'm not ready yet. And I'd say, no, you're fine.
And who is that? Do you know his name?
The fella in Stephen Street. I think he's a Palestinian guy. But he had a beautiful cat for a while. And she used to come up and lie in my lap. Because I had no cat. Because I have a dog now. And the dog, she'd eat cats. Like. So I really missed cats. I would always advise a hairdresser to
get a cat. Ali Breslin Garabagot. Open Mic,
the podcast. Live your life your way at home with Davida Home Care.
Brought to you by WLR.